Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami. The Other Profile by Irene Graziosi. Kevin Systrom, the founder of Instagram, recently confessed that the platform he helped create had lost its soul. Gone are the days when friends and family shared photos with earnest and eager passion. Now influencers reign supreme. It's terrifying, Systrom said on the journalist Kara Swisher's podcast. It's this race to the bottom of who can be the most perfect. Maya, the sharp-tongued protagonist of Irene Graziosi's debut novel, The Other Profile, already knows this. She thinks of Instagram profiles like vision boards, evidence of aspiration, not reflections of reality. Her own page counters the trend with an ascetic banality. She prefers not to be perceived. Maya's a depressed graduate school dropout living in Milan with her boyfriend, Filippo. He was a professor at the university where she was enrolled, and their courtship was a sweaty encounter of grief, Maya's after the death of her sister, and desperation, his. Now their relationship is sustained by mutual ambivalence. Filippo wishes Maya would do more than eat gummy bears and watch Olivia Benson solve crimes on TV. Maya hates that Filippo dragged her away from Paris and into a city where he is respected and she is unknown. Maya eventually gets a job, first as a bartender and then as an assistant to an influencer named Gloria, a teenager with millions of Instagram followers. It turns out assistant is a conservative take on what she's asking Maya to do. I'll need someone who can help me in the public transition from being a high schooler to being something else, Gloria tells her. As part of the job, Maya not only recommends books, writes speeches, and composes social media captions, she is also expected to be Gloria's soul. Grazioso, the founder of a cultural YouTube channel and magazine, is particularly attuned to the language of the chronically online. Her novel, which is translated from the Italian by Lucy Rand, is at its most nimble when Maya observes influencer culture. The sponsored events, brand meetings, and vague cliches about self-love are fodder for her acerbic judgments and acid humor. Gloria's world is filled with frauds, and Maya loves to call them out. The pair's relationship enters dangerous territory when Maya finds herself first obsessed with and then consumed by Gloria. A mandate issued by Gloria's manager about her client still haunts me. You have to give her a personality, she tells Maya. That's how she works. She's an empty vessel. As Gloria extracts more and more from Maya, I kept waiting for the novel to make good on the suggestion of psychological thrill. But the stakes of Maya and Gloria's increased mutual dependence hardly simmer. Graziosi divides attention between this parasitic bond, Maya's failing relationship with Filippo, and how Maya mourns her sister, Eva. Grazioso tries to knit these threads together to add layers of suspense and mystery, but her language struggles to keep up with the demands of the story. There's an over-reliance on direct exposition to carry us through scenes, which undercuts the charm and acuity of Maya's wry voice in the novel's early pages. It also softens any tension. Impatience creeps in as nervy prose is replaced with colorless revelations like, I'm sometimes caught out by how much I've changed, even since the previous week. I can't say precisely what these changes are. The Other Profile lumbers around, depriving us of specificity as it submits to cliché. By the end, I wondered what Maya, with her lacerating opinions, would think of this fate. How she might feel to know that the intensity of her relationship with Gloria had been tempered by the same hazy sentiments she once mocked. Maybe she'd shrug, or, considering the way Systrom now feels about Instagram, maybe she'd find it kind of terrifying. This review was written by Lovia Gajarki. Formerly an associate editor at the New York Times Magazine Labs, she's currently a critic at The Hollywood Reporter. A Fire So Wild by Sarah Ruiz Grossman. In her bracing debut novel, A Fire So Wild, Sarah Ruiz Grossman chronicles a community in Berkeley, California, on the brink of personal and environmental calamity as a wildfire threatens life as they know it. The story follows a diverse cast, each character navigating his or her own private crises, be they marital, economic, or existential. We open with Abigail, an out-of-touch affordable housing advocate nearing her 50th birthday, contemplating her career during a morning swim in Lake Onza. Abigail is feeling disillusioned by her life's work when an idea sparks. She will turn her birthday party into a fundraiser for a mixed-income housing project, hosting the event at her friend's hillside mansion. Next, we meet Sunny and Willow, a homeless couple sleeping in a van parked on Berkeley's shoreline. Working in construction, Sunny builds extravagant homes in the hills, all the while praying that he and Willow land a spot in the affordable housing units designed in a new high-rise, the very project Abigail is working on. Meanwhile, Willow fatefully meets Abigail at a soup kitchen and is hired to cater Abigail's fundraiser. Then there is Abigail's wife, Taylor, a startup founder turned stay-at-home mother who is feeling hollowed out by her life and scheming to leave Abigail after her birthday. Their teenage son, Xavier, suspects a rift between them but avoids interfering. He instead focuses on the transfer student, Mar, who's grappling with a family issue of her own. Parents, Gabriel and Camilla, have separated. Everybody is struggling in some way, and all the while the wildfire looms. Matters eventually escalate the night of the fundraiser. While the party is underway, Berkeley residents receive emergency alerts warning them to evacuate. Those at the fundraiser, including Abigail, Taylor, and Willow, begin to scramble, but Xavier is down the street, having stealthily invited Mar to his house. They are alone and without cell service, ignorant of what is to come. As the novel's assorted cast races to escape the blaze, their lives become critically linked. Ruiz Grossman balances the social and political, the emotional and physical, with insight and precision. Her disparate characters all hail from different worlds, and it's a horrific thrill to witness their dramas unfurl and collide. Through the juxtapositions they experience, like Sunny laboring over hilltop mansions, wondering if the wealthy homeowners will consider the workers whose sweat had dripped onto the slats of their wood floors, whose skin cells were embedded in their windowsills. Ruiz Grossman highlights gross economic disparity and the falsity of upward mobility. At times, the novel's political discourse can feel forced upon the narrative, resulting in moments of stilted dialogue and formulaic characters. Ruiz Grossman's writing is finest when she tackles the devastation of climate change. Even before the fire bursts onto the scene, her descriptions of the natural world are bewitching and distressing. Chalky rocks, wild tree roots, and long grass that used to be hidden beneath the line of the water were all visible now, Abigail thinks of a lake depleting under a severe drought. They looked naked, exposed, like they hadn't asked for any of this. Her prose is equally sharp and evocative when the fire finally does arrive. A burnt orange sky hung low, as though night had fallen and a hellish sun had risen in its place. There's a second fire later in the novel, this time not coming down from above, but sparked from below, as a few characters take radical action to send a message. It's a satisfying punch that probes a question at the core of A Fire So Wild. When disaster strikes, whom does society rescue, and whom does it abandon? This review was written by Kayla Mayuri, who is the author of Mother in the Dark. Splinters, Another Kind of Love Story, by Leslie Jamieson. We live in a golden age of autobiographical women's writing. Real equality in publishing is still elusive, but the straight male inner world that was so meticulously, relentlessly documented in prize-winning books of the past century, from Roth to Styron to Ford, has been forced at last from its position of unchallenged supremacy. In its place has arisen a group of brilliant women, inclusive of trans women, with their own ideas for the form, among them Maggie Nelson, Eula Biss, Valeria Luiselli, Margot Jefferson, Alice Bechtel, Rachel Cusk, Karina Chocano, and Leslie Jameson. Jameson, now 40, is the author of a new memoir called Splinters. It tells the story of her divorce and first years as a single mother. In her previous books, the finest of which remains The Empathy Exams, Jameson often used hybrid forms, crossing autobiography with journalism and essays. In Splinters, however, as if the urgency of motherhood has retired the need for those inflecting techniques, she tells her tale straightforwardly. Nevertheless, her true subject has stayed intact, the tormented ambiguity of all action, ethical and aesthetic and personal, and the consequent divisions of the self, what Virginia Woolf called the butterfly shades of consciousness. One piece of me said, "It's unbearable," Jameson writes, about being apart from her baby. The other piece said, "It's fine." Both pieces were lying. Nothing was fine, and nothing was unbearable. As Splinters begins, Jameson and her husband, C., are in the initial stages of their separation. At drop-offs, as I stood with the baby in the stroller beside me, he called from the vestibule, "Why don't you eat something, you anorexic bitch?" Or he said, "Don't you, expletive, talk to me," when I said, "Please don't speak to me like that." He leaned closer to say, "I can speak to you however I, expletive, want." In another drop-off scene, he spits at her. This is bitter proof of how monstrous love can turn. But Jameson, whose powerful mind is geared toward dialectic, finds as ballast for that injury an immense, nuanced, often physical hope in her newborn daughter. "Sometimes I felt the baby belonged to me absolutely," she writes. "Sometimes, when she lay sleeping beside me in her bassinet, I ran my fingers along my scar in the darkness, the thick stitches, the shelf of skin above like an overhang of rock. It was just a slit that led to my own insides, but it felt like a gateway to another world, the place she'd come from." Soon Jameson returns ambivalently to teaching. "I never felt doubled. I felt more like half a mother, half a teacher," and begins seeing new men, whom, like C., she calls by distancing nicknames, the tumbleweed, the ex-philosopher, as if to declare the privacy of her reflections from them. Splinters is about how she is fragmented, splintered, into these different selves. "Part of me yearned for my daughter," she writes, "but another part of me wanted only to be a woman on an open highway, with her feet on the dashboard and a man's hand on her thigh." The recent high water mark for this kind of book is probably "I Love You, But I've Chosen Darkness" by Claire V. Watkins, a blazing comet of an autobiographical novel, which is also about motherhood. Splinters doesn't possess its energy or drive. Jameson's The Recovering, a dense and courageous book about her alcoholism, did, but this is a more cautious, mercurial project. Perhaps that's because it shows an author in transition, not just a person. Jameson's excellent prose has always retained the aura of the MFA, the sacral feelings about writing as a vocation, the incredibly careful similes, as if a firing squad awaited each one in judgment. In some lines of Splinters, this style threatens to give way under the weight of the book's scarcely acknowledged privilege. That summer I was invited to a literary festival on Capri. Yet at other times, Jameson finds a voice that is wilder, angrier, funnier, free. "Lush milk nights and rumpled clothes," she writes with fraught joy, in one of the many moments in Splinters that act as a passport directly into the experience of motherhood, chapped lips and soaked bras. For a long time, woman writer was an epithet in literary culture. Jameson and her peers are something much subtler, writers investigating womanhood as a category in the world, a way of being perceived, a set of challenges and fears, In part, the subject of this beautiful, bittersweet memoir is the pressure of that task. It's true that I didn't want her to be away from me, even for a moment, Jameson writes of her daughter, during her hospital stay after giving birth. But it's also true that once she was gone, I pulled out my laptop. This review was written by Charles Finch, who is an author, most recently, of What Just Happened, a chronicle of 2020. What Have We Here? Portraits of a Life by Billy D. Williams. My first awareness of Billy D. Williams was the stuff of hushed beauty parlor conversation I was too young to appreciate. After all these years, he's still fine, elders whispered in my periphery as they flipped through an interview in an ebony magazine that was treated as an heirloom. His piercing gaze leapt out across time. That's our Billy, another giggled. As he tells it in What Have We Here, his effortlessly charming new memoir, the actor's only ambition was to be everyone's Billy, a star to cross color lines. Modeling his life on visions of old Hollywood glamour, he wanted to be heralded not just by black women fantasizing about their chance to be with him, but by teens, men, children, and people of all colors and circumstances. Playing Lando Calrissian in the Star Wars trilogy, the debonair, cape-wearing, and bravado-filled hero of interstellar proportions eventually granted Williams his wish, catapulting him into the public stratosphere. He wasn't written black or white, Williams points out. He was beyond that, bigger than that. He was a star. Williams was born in 1937 at the tail end of the Harlem Renaissance, the artistic and cultural movement of the 1920s and 30s, when black possibility bloomed. Nina Mae McKinney, believed to be the first black actress with a Hollywood contract, and Hulan Jack, Manhattan's first black borough president, lived on his block on West 110th Street. He and his twin sister, named Lady, were welcomed into a world stitched together with love he would spend his life emulating. Their grandmother, Annette Lewis Bodkin, the queen dowager of the home, laid down the rule of law. Loretta Bodkin, their mother, was a trained opera singer and friend of Lena Horne, who dreamed of fame and toiled to ensure her children could do what she was unable to. Their father, William December Williams, was a laborer who worked long hours to support his family and helped his son develop a sense of style. He taught me how to put a hat on, Williams writes, using two fingers and a thumb, grasping the brim in a way that prevented my fingerprints from smearing the crown. Making his stage debut at 7 years old in The Firebrand of Florence, Billy D. knew he was destined to be an artist. He graduated from the High School of Music and Art with a concentration in painting, a craft through which he continues to express himself. While attending the National Academy of Fine Arts and Design in Manhattan, he overheard a classmate talking about getting acting work as an extra and figured he should also give it a shot. A CBS casting director spotted Williams in a clothing store in 1956 and set in motion the first phase of his career. The versatile actor came to mass consciousness in the 1971 television tearjerker Brian Song, where he played the football player Gale Sayers, opposite James Caan. He has the rare gift to convincingly be tough, suave, or romantic, a leading man in movies like Lady Sings the Blues and Mahogany, who came to be dubbed the Black Clark Gable. By necessity, though, he made a career from the scraps of precarity offered to him. I wanted to be known as one of the best actors of my generation, period, Williams maintains, but the opportunities weren't the same for me as they were for Gable, and I was frustrated. Like many celebrity memoirs, What Have We Here is a chance for Williams to reclaim the public record. He writes with clarity and intimacy, revealing the person behind the persona. And he doesn't scrimp on the dirty details, weighing in on the marriages, and yes, the many affairs, friendships with James Baldwin, Diane Carroll, and Marlon Brando, and becoming Mr. Colt 45. At 86, he still enjoys the ride, but hasn't forgotten to savor the magic. This book is an invitation to join him. This review was written by Maya S. Cade, who is the creator and curator of Black Film Archive, and a scholar in residence at the Library of Congress. Held by Anne Michaels. Anne Michaels has served as Toronto's poet laureate, so it's no surprise that her latest novel, Held, turns a multi-generational family saga into a lyrical jigsaw of images and observations, a trigger to the long fuse of memory always alight. It begins in the trenches of World War I with a soldier's impressions of what's essentially a 450-mile grave, and ends in the near future as one of his descendants walks the streets of a city on the Gulf of Finland. In between, Michael's narrative glides gracefully back and forth in time, from North Yorkshire in the 1920s to rural Suffolk in the 1980s, then all the way to 1908 Paris. John, the soldier we first meet in 1917, returns from the war to his wife Helena and his photography studio. Haunted by what he has seen, or not seen, he leaves a legacy that will send his daughter and granddaughter to other front lines, this time working in field hospitals and refugee camps, the most dangerous places. Each brief chapter is filled with deftly sketched characters, a war correspondent tasked with writing what no one could bear to read, a widow encountering an unexpectedly kindred spirit as she trudges across a snowy landscape, even Marie Curie, whose courage is recalled by one of her closest friends. Throughout, these stories spark both poignant connections and provocative divergences. Those whose lives follow John's must find their own way to survive in this new world with new degrees of grief, many more degrees in the scale of blessedness and torment. Where the Dead Wait by Allie Wilkes. Survival and how far a person will go to achieve it is at the heart of Allie Wilkes's Where the Dead Wait, which her publisher aptly describes as an eerie atmospheric polar gothic. William Day was a lowly young fourth lieutenant when the deaths of his superior officers gave him command of a ship stranded in the Arctic ice. He made it back to civilization, but emerged with the cannibalistic moniker Eat'em Fresh Day. 13 years later, his former second-in-command, a dashing American named Jesse Stevens, has gone missing in the very same region. Now, in the winter of 1882, the Admiralty orders Day to go find him. Complications abound, both logistical and psychological. Day's relationship with Stevens was intense, to say the very least. And as the new expedition becomes trapped in the far north, Day is haunted by the earlier group's travails, presented in alternating chapters. Eating human flesh may not have been the only horrific act committed back then, and new crimes could be uncovered in Stephen's wake. Even the lost adventurer's domineering wife, a spirit medium who travels with a pet skull, begins to doubt the wisdom of joining this ill-fated mission. The ice has swung shut behind them like a cemetery gate, leading Day's crew toward a possible mutiny. Haunting visions and ominous clues leave no one's sanity untested. What is the significance of a hideous mask made from the hide of a killer whale, and of unearthing the figurehead of a ship that was supposed to have sunk hundreds of miles away? True to the novel's title, there are plenty of dead men waiting to be found, and it's not just the light that plays tricks out here. Getting to Sorry, The Art of Apology at Work and at Home by Marjorie Ingle and Susan McCarthy. From advice for accepting apologies and teaching children how to make them, to analyses of the half-hearted sorries of corporations and celebrities, and a six-step formula for apologizing well, Ingle and McCarthy delve into a word that is harder to say than it seems. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.